Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 219. It's Monday, July 10th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's start first up with some stories about the single largest preventable cause of death in the United States, which is tobacco. And, of course, we're having to add in vaping with that, but this one primarily deals with tobacco. So let's go with first up from MedPage Today. Places with smoke-free laws have the best health outcomes. Laws against smoking went hand-in-hand with population-level health outcomes across various countries, a new meta-analysis found. Implementation of smoke-free legislation was associated with a lowered risk for all cardiovascular disease by 10%, respiratory system disease by 17%, reported Ryoka Nakamura of the Research Center for Health Policy and Economics at Hitachibashi University of Tokyo. Smoke-free legislation was also associated with a reduction in adverse birth outcomes of 6%, according to the meta-analysis published in JAMA Network Open. Nakamura's group noted that these tobacco control policies may have the power to not only potentially limit an individual's smoking habits, but change a larger population's exposure to secondhand smoke. Rapid declines in cardiovascular disease conditions may be associated with decreases in exposure to secondhand smoke after the implementation of smoke-free laws. Even low doses of exposure to toxins in tobacco smoke have been found to increase the risk of cardiovascular disease conditions through various channels, such as activation of blood platelets, increasing arterial stiffness, and others. Smoke-free legislation policies were the most common population-level intervention, followed by tax or price increase policies, multi-component tobacco control programs, and lastly, minimum age laws to purchase cigarettes. Associations between smoke-free legislation and improved health outcomes were consistent across all subgroup analyses present in the study, other than national income level. Only countries with a higher income had reductions in negative health outcomes following tobacco control legislation. Not sure exactly why this is, but it may have to do with the literal and social infrastructure of those societies. Maybe the effects and the maybe unfortunate workarounds for smoking may be easier in lower income countries. Okay, well, next up, another story on tobacco. This from Medical Express. Here are the 12 states where smoking rates are 50% higher than the rest of the country. Despite overall declines in smoking, Americans who live in the South and Midwest are still much more likely to smoke and smoke more than those living in other states, a new report shows. A nonprofit non-smoking advocacy group has identified what it calls Tobacco Nation, areas of the South and Midwest where smoking is 50% more common than in other states. The Truth Initiative revealed that those states are Alabama, Arkansas, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, good old Ohio, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and West Virginia. Due in part to policies that favor the tobacco industry over public health, residents of Tobacco Nation are too often suffering from shorter life expectancy, worse indicators of health, and high prevalence of tobacco use, said Barbara Shilo, Chief Research Officer of the Truth Initiative. About 19% of adults smoke in this region compared to 13% in other states. Young adults were similarly affected, with 11% of adults under 25 smoking compared to 8% in other states. Teens were also more likely to smoke. The Truth Initiative also found that people in those states who smoke tend to light up more than smokers in other states, using about 53 packs in a year on average. In other parts of country, the average is 29 packs a year. So that's a pretty striking difference, like a 60% more, over 60% more. In turn, life expectancy is lower in these states by about 3 years at age 76. Adults in 9 of the 12 states also have high rates of e-cigarette use or vaping that are among the highest. Now, this is interesting because, as I've reported before, you know, a lot of time when vaping first started out, folks often considered it as an alternative to smoking and thought that maybe it would even reduce smoking rates. I reported last week that that's not really true. But in fact, the highest rates of tobacco use is also present with the highest rates of vaping. Truth Initiative blames the numbers on weaker local policy on tobacco prevention and cessation. Industry influence and lack of political will by those who govern are among the reasons why. Tobacco use is a leading cause of preventable death, disability, and death, according to the U.S. CDC, killing nearly 500,000 people every year through first and second hand smoke. Okay, well, next up, I want to drill down on the state of Ohio and look at the American Lung Association's State of Tobacco Control 2023, specifically for Ohio, and measures it in five areas. First up, tobacco prevention and cessation funding. We get an F in Ohio. Ohio is only spending 13% of the CDC's recommended total on tobacco prevention and cessation at the state level. Okay, next up, a little better news. Smoke-free air. Ohio gets an A. Woohoo! Because smoking is prohibited in a wide variety of public places. Now back to bad news, tobacco taxes. Ohio gets an F. Ohio only has a per pack tax of $1.60. And that's way less than recommended and lower than most states. Access to state cessation programs, C. This is because there is coverage of medication and counseling in Medicaid and state employee health plans, but there's not mandated coverage in private insurance. Also, the state runs a quit line, which is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. So if you or someone you care about is smoking and they're interested in quitting smoking, they can call the quit line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. And the last area they're ranked on is flavored tobacco products. Ohio gets an F, failing grade, because there are no restrictions on the use of flavored tobacco products in Ohio. That's particularly important since menthol cigarettes and the like are more popular among African Americans, which suffer more cardiovascular disease and such. And also for kids, a lot of the flavorings are inducements for kids to start smoking. Nicotine is the only inducement you need after you start smoking, one of the most addictive substances on earth. Okay, well, next up, I want to report on a small breakthrough in the gun violence front. This from NPR. CDC helping states address gun injuries after years of political roadblocks. Each year, Utah sees its share of accidental injuries caused by firearms. When state health officials looked carefully at the hundreds of injuries that required emergency treatment in hospitals, they found most resulted from lapses in the most basic elements of gun safety. Nearly three-quarters of all unintentional injuries in the state are to males between the age of 15 to 44, most of whom accidentally shoot themselves while mishandling or cleaning the weapons. With funding from the CDC, Utah streamlined its data collection on gun injuries and used that information to create a public service campaign to help prevent accidental gun injuries. But getting to that point required a compromise in a 1996 federal rule that prohibited the CDC from using federal funds to advocate or promote gun control. The amendment made access to granular information, things like who is being injured by firearms and the circumstances that caused those injuries, difficult to come by for health officials, policymakers, and politicians. It would often take a year or longer to get the statistics as they work their way from hospitals and through the public health bureaucracy. That has frustrated efforts to address the tens of thousands of gun deaths that occur in the United States each year. Starting in 2020, however, nine states and D.C. have received money from the CDC to set up pilot programs to speed the dissemination of this data and the goal of using it for better public health approaches to the problem. The near real-time data gleaned through the firearms injury surveillance through emergency rooms program, the FASTER program, spurred Utah to launch its public service campaign 3 years ago, parsing age data and type of non-fatal injury, which includes intentional, self-directed, unintentional, and assault-related, helped with the messaging, said Joel Johnson, communication coordinator for the Violence and Injury Prevention Program at the state's Department of Health and Human Services. Marissa Zawald of the CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control says that she helped launch FASTER 3 years ago. The main goal was to address the timeliness issue in our firearm injury data at the national level. Our traditional surveillance systems to monitor firearm injuries are usually lagged by about 2 years, she says. A path around a ban on studying gun violence and prevention. FASTER grants of around $225,000 to states involved in the pilot program have allowed them to set up tools to pull the codes physicians use on electronic hospital records to record patient diagnoses. The money was made available by a congressional compromise over the 1996 Dickey Amendment. The amendment had largely stifled government research to study firearm violence and prevention. However, in 2018, Congress agreed to free up to $25 million for research, and the money was included in a 2020 spending bill. Amanda Delina Morse, who helped set up Washington State's FASTER program, says previously a large number of state and county health departments were paid by CDC to engage in lots of sort of opioid-related surveillance and response work, and that FASTER mirrored some of those methods and procedures. With opioids, Washington worked with health officials at the local level to share data, which in turn helped improve the effectiveness of prevention, intervention, and treatment programs. The hope is that more rapid availability of firearm injury data will result in similar successes. A more complete picture of gun violence. Kanine Zamore, an epidemiologist with the Washington, D.C. Department of Health, says that traditionally most firearm injury data has come from law enforcement, but that doesn't present the full picture. Not all firearm injuries are tied to the prosecution of or a criminal complaint, he says. Washington, D.C. has used some of its CDC funding through the FASTER program to create a public dashboard that went live in recent weeks. It pulls in diagnostic data as well as age and ethnicity of victims, including the ward and zip code where they live. Among other things, the dashboard currently shows an alarming 18% year-on-year increase in firearm-related visits to hospital emergency departments. A heat map on the site also indicates that around 11 p.m. is the peak time of day for hospital visits related to firearm injuries. Further, Zamore says D.C. has found that as many as 40% of people in the district who show up at hospitals with non-fatal gun injuries go on to be killed by a firearm. So, being able to identify and successfully intervene to prevent further violence is likely to save lives. One way that information is being used to prepare hospital-based violent interruption programs designed to de-escalate conflict and offer mediation to resolve conflicts between potential assailants and victims. Where these programs have been introduced, they have proven very effective. It all goes back to pump handles, says Morris. It's a concept in public health that traces its origins to the 1854 London cholera outbreak. When the city removed the pump handle to a drinking well, it proved contaminated water was the culprit. For firearms, you're not going to be able to find your pump handle if you don't understand all those non-fatal incidents, she says. Okay, well, it's nice to see a workaround of that 1996 law kind of passed under the right-wing Republican view that if you don't measure it, it isn't a problem. And while that one was a win for the CDC, this next one's a loss from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. CDC to reduce funding for states' child vaccination programs. The CDC is reducing funding to states for child vaccination programs, according to an agency email obtained by Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. The funding cut is, quote, a significant change to your budget, the email to immunization managers dated June 27th and signed by two CDC officials said. There will be no easy solution for this, said the CDC email. We know that this change will require some tough decisions. Agency officials linked the reduction to the debt ceiling deal recently struck by the Biden administration and Congress. The cut may result in less complete reporting on vaccinations, the CDC said. The debt deal rescinded about $27 billion in unspent federal money that had been allocated to fight COVID. It also led the CDC to remove $400 million in funding to states for workers who fight the spread of sexually transmitted infections, according to an email obtained by Congressional Quarterly Roll Call. Claire Hannon, executive director of the Association of Immunization Managers, said that jurisdictions are reporting that the cut amounts to 10% or more of their previous year's award. The targeted cuts will affect programs that identify communities vulnerable to disease outbreaks. This information is used to prevent and manage outbreaks. The budget cut comes as the number of children getting vaccinated dropped amid the COVID pandemic. They're still trying to fully recover from that. A little more difficult with less resources. Okay, well, next up, a story that falls under the category of shooting oneself in the foot. This also from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Idaho drops panel investigating pregnancy-related deaths in U.S. maternal as U.S. maternal mortality surges. On July 1st, Idaho became the only state without a legal requirement or specialized committee to review maternal deaths related to pregnancy. The change came after state lawmakers, in the midst of a national upsurge in maternal deaths, decided not to extend a sunset date for the panel set in 2019 when they established the state's Maternal Mortality Review Committee. The committee disbanded despite a high rate of maternal mortality in the United States that exceeds those of other high-income countries. The U.S. recorded 24 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births in 2020, compared with about 8 in Canada and less than 4 in Germany, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the CDC. And the U.S. rate is sharply rising. In March, a few weeks before Idaho lawmakers adjourned their 2023 session, the CDC released data that showed the maternal mortality rate in the U.S. climbed in 2021 to 33 deaths from the previous 24. Idaho has a particularly acute problem. Its pregnancy-related mortality ratio was 42 pregnancy-related deaths per 100,000 live births in 2020. And that, of course, may be higher now because that's using the older data. Hillary Hagen of Idaho Voices for Children, a nonprofit focused on low and moderate income families, said that the committee used the Idaho-specific data to do a deep dive analysis and that an information void would be left by shuttering the board. How do we make decisions and policy decisions to improve the health of mothers and their babies if we're not tracking the data, she asked. From our perspective, having consistent data and trends shown over time helps make more sound policy decisions. The decision to disband the board came as two hospitals that serve rural hospitals announced that they would stop providing services for expectant mothers. One of the hospitals cited trouble recruiting and retaining OB-GYNs after the state last summer enacted one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. The committee, tasked with investigating deaths both individually and collectively, found that almost half of the maternal deaths in Idaho in 2020 occurred after delivery. So if you find that a little surprising, I've reported on that earlier, some of those deaths that occur in the first year after delivery among recent moms and new moms is violence and substance use deaths. Violence including domestic violence and suicide. Amelia Huntsberger, an OB-GYN and member of the committee, noted also that patients covered by Medicaid during pregnancy are overrepresented in maternal death rates, which led the panel to recommend expansion of postpartum Medicaid coverage to 12 months rather than the current 60 days in Idaho. Huntsberger made national headlines this year when she announced plans to leave both her job and the state, citing the state's abortion ban and the move to dissolve the committee. But in their legislative session, Idaho lawmakers decided not to advance a bill that would have embraced the committee's recommendation to expand postpartum Medicaid coverage, which, by the way, has been done in many red Republican states that haven't necessarily expanded, done the full Medicaid expansion, but have expanded around postpartum, moving it up from less than a year up to at least a year. The committee, whose members say annual operation costs stand at about $15,000, was deemed budget neutral, running at no cost to the state. So even within the budget, it wasn't costing the state any money. And spending $15,000, a pittance when you're looking at the problem of maternal mortality. Shooting ourselves in the foot. In an interview with Kaiser Family Foundation Health News, Marco Erickson, vice chair of the Health and Welfare Committee, said Idaho's Republican Party has been focused on reducing government spending. He said the same maternal data could be adequately culled through epidemiology reports already published by the Department of Health and Welfare. Elke Shaw-Tulloch, Public Health Administrator at the Department of Health and Welfare, said the department would, quote, continue to collect raw data on maternal deaths and gather as much data as possible through limited existing sources. But, she said, it will not have the ability to mandate reporting on cases or convene committee members to investigate deaths. So you can have raw data, but if you're not looking at it or analyzing it, it doesn't do a lot of good. Now, most of these maternal mortality review committees have been set up in the last decade, but actually here in Lucas County, when I was a health planner in the early 2000s, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department set up that committee as it was determined that it's very cost effective. That's one of the most vulnerable points in life is around pregnancy and the postpartum period, particularly the year right after birth. Okay, next up, I want to go big with an article from The Lancet. And this article is entitled Equity in Decline, Fair Distribution in a Worse Off World. So I've reported plenty about how life expectancy has decreased in the U.S. Since around 2015, and that we've seen an increase in deaths and despair and a lot of other, violence, suicides have increased in the U.S. And that's been a change for generations and generations and generations. There was pretty much a steady increase in life expectancy. That has been true also throughout the world. And actually, in recent decades, that's been true even in the poorest parts of the world. In fact, some of the most benefit has been in the poor and middle-income countries. But now we're starting to see, just like in the U.S., a reversal of those trends. So this article is about getting the fact that rather than from moving from a paradigm where we're used to having health increase, is that we're actually seeing a world that's going to be worse off. So that itself is going to require a whole change in our way of thinking. But also, how do you maintain equity? How do you maintain and build equity amidst that decline? Because as things start going downhill, we know that in most cases, what happens is those most vulnerable take the worst brunt of it. And if we can buffer that a bit and achieve and build some equity, that can make the world less worse off, even though that may be the direction we're going. So here we go. In 1948, with the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, equity was globally recognized as integral to human well-being. In the decades that have followed, advances were made worldwide in health and well-being with substantial reductions in extreme poverty and improvements in life expectancy and other health and social outcomes. Unfortunately, this progress coexists with persistent socioeconomic disparities within and between countries. In 2015, all the member states of the UN pledged to, quote, leave no one behind, with the Sustainable Development Goals, furthering their commitments to a fairer world and ensuring that as socioeconomic advantages of development accrue, that those who are poor and marginalized could receive a greater share of the benefits of growth. Yet worsening and often intersecting global crises during the 21st century, including global warming, ecological crisis, conflict and violence, and shortages of essentials such as food and water, presage a potential sustained decline in human health and well-being. These threats, combined with social and political fragmentation in some settings, and increasing inequalities globally and within countries, could render obsolete conventional strategies toward an equitable world. Creating a fair world under stable or improving socioeconomic conditions has proved challenging. There has been no collective transnational agreement on an equitable distribution of the socioeconomic gains of the past century. In the past 10 years, the world's richest 1% accrued almost 50% of all newly created wealth. Indeed, the continuing economic crises and the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic underlined how badly equity is managed in times of global distress, with women, people living in poverty, and other marginalized groups disproportionately affected. Furthermore, following the development of COVID-19 vaccines, governments prioritized nationalism over global solidarity. High-income countries were reluctant to share vaccines, providing further evidence of inequitable tendencies when faced with resource constraints. These examples underscore the challenges humanity could face in a world of sustained economic, environmental, and resource decline. In such a scenario, declines in health and well-being would be expected, with the risk that health and socioeconomic disparities increase, pushing marginalized groups even further behind. The science and the data of climate change and environmental crisis are unfolding and indicate risks of future health and well-being. So too is the evidence of the disproportionate negative impacts on the most marginalized populations. In a future world in sustained decline, the conventional understanding of equity will be inadequate. Theoretical and practical approaches to equity were developed in the second half of the 20th century within the context of a world where many health and well-being indicators were improving. Although there are examples of communities managing decline and scarcity, such as an economically isolated Cuba in the 1990s, or indigenous communities facing resource crises, they do not generally address long-term sustained global decline. There is no framework for translating these 20th century approaches to equity in a world in decline. In a declining world, the resources typically distributed to support health and well-being must extend beyond goods, for instance, food, water, and shelter, and services, health, education, security, to include community-held resources such as territory, such as when islands disappear or fertile land turns to desert, and political power, that is, the power to determine who is entitled to membership in the resource-sharing community itself. Equity pivots on resource distribution, because in a declining world, it will be access to diminishing resources that protects human capabilities, health, and well-being. A global conversation is needed with a broad national and community representation about fair resource distribution, reflecting our shared planet and its potentially declining capacity for human habitation. The dialogue needs to involve all stakeholders, especially those who are marginalized and at greatest risk of being left behind. Resistance to measures that promote and protect equity will exacerbate resource competition, global exploitation, and suffering. There are already some evidence of these challenges. At the country level, it is in the arguments for low-income and middle-income countries to be exempt from carbon emissions control so they can grow economically, rather than for high-income countries to share resources more equitably. At an individual level, it is reflected in the super-rich accumulating wealth and contributing to climate change while securing climate-safe havens, shielding themselves from the consequences of a world in decline. Hardin's tragedy of the commons could become a reality, whereby each group hopes to protect or improve its position at the expense of others by exploiting and hoarding diminishing resources fastest. Resistance to policies and interventions that promote equity in a worse-off world will jeopardize human rights and health. The right to health, for instance, is subject to progressive realization and awaits sufficient government resources and interests to prioritize its realization. However, in a world of declining resources in which equity is abjured, sufficient resources will never become available for the realization of the right as currently understood. The bodies and enabling governance architecture capable of bringing together the diversity of stakeholders necessary to ensure that equity is not resisted, diminished, or lost in a declining world partly lie in the United Nations systems. The United Nations General Assembly, the UN Economic and Social Council, and the World Health Assembly. Relevant opportunities to explicitly address equity include the UN High-Level Meeting on Universal Health Coverage in September 2023, the UN Climate Change Conference in November 2023, and the ongoing work of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Body for Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness, and Response. These bodies could facilitate a dialogue and framework that draws on equity, human rights, and justice to make collective, intentional decisions about managing the harms arising from a world facing decline and the protection of health and well-being. By planning ahead and with the support of a broad-based coalition of supranational and subnational stakeholders, the processes needed to limit inequity can be put in place by governments to reduce the potential burdens of a declining world. For example, investments through national and global financing mechanisms ahead of decline could strengthen infrastructure, health, education and social services, and community resilience. Such investments could also promote political discourse to address crucial challenges, with a goal to improve the social determinants of health and the disparities in those social determinants. Independent monitoring of changes in equity will be essential to track progress and address disparities effectively. Strong monitoring also entails accountability mechanisms to ensure there is trust in the progress. Managing equity in a declining world is a new territory And beyond the traditional measures of socioeconomic and geographical disparities, monitoring mechanisms will be a developing area. Existing human rights frameworks, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and supporting covenants and declarations, might be inadequate for the task of reducing inequity in a world of sustained decline because of the way rights are currently envisaged for a world that is static or improving. This inadequacy could necessitate a reorientation. The roles of nation states and global governance systems will probably also need rethinking. The need arises because current practice is that a nation state's obligations to human well-being end at its borders, and the idea that rights transcend borders is being challenged. Effective participation of marginalized groups in the equity conversation and frank discussions about global power dynamics will be imperative. To confront the real possibility of declining world and maintain global commitments to protect human health and well-being, the global community and governments and other national stakeholders will need to address the equitable distribution of inevitable harms. People will be worse off in a world of declining resources. Global discourse on equity and decline is essential to safeguard fairness and ensure health and well-being, that health and well-being are protected to minimize future health disparities. So a lot of this is tied up in kind of like the U.S. is led in kind of a frontier mentality and leading in kind of extractive economies. And in this country, as elsewhere in the world, this kind of scarcity mentality and increasing scarcity, actual scarcity, has led to grievance politics, which has been kind of right-wing and fascist. So that's probably something we would like to avoid. Well, probably the good news, I think, as a thread running through this from public health science, is that actually increasing equity in a population, regardless of the resources, whether they're stable, increasing, or decreasing, actually improves the relative status of the entire population. Justice is actually better than injustice.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, I want to do a story on a common nutritional deficiency, this from The Hill. More than one-third of young women in the U.S. suffer from iron deficiency. More than a third of American women between the ages of 12 and 21 have an iron deficiency, according to new research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The research published online last week found nearly 39% of American girls and women aged 12 to 21 were affected by iron deficiency, and 6% were iron deficient anemic. While iron deficiency, or low iron in the body, often presents no symptoms, the more severe iron deficiency anemia impacts red blood cells and hemoglobin levels and can cause tiredness, shortness of breath, heart palpitations, and other symptoms. Left untreated, iron deficiency anemia can make the body more prone to infection and cause complications in pregnancy. Though menstruation was found to be a risk factor for iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia in the young women, more than a quarter of girls who had not yet hit the onset of their periods also had iron deficiency. The study concludes that risk factors for iron deficiency, like low iron intake and extensive menstrual blood loss, are not clearly defined, and that current screening guidelines may miss many individuals with iron deficiency. So, you know, iron is present in a lot of foods, except pretty much dairy is about the only thing that doesn't really have much. But iron from animal sources, again, dairy products don't have any iron, so it doesn't really help. But meat, basically, is actually very easily absorbed. In fact, for many people, getting too much iron can be a problem. Like many things, too much or too little is a problem. In America, we seem to really love those extremes. So probably having high iron is a problem for a lot of people, but low iron is a problem for a lot of people, particularly women, since menstruation and the loss of blood is going to, you lose iron in your body. But the fact that even young girls who aren't menstruating are just about as common to have iron deficiency is more reflective of just a poor diet in general. Now, grains and stuff, even refined grains, which aren't the greatest food to eat, are actually iron fortified. But plant iron, the form of iron that's present in plants, is not absorbed as well. Now, one way to increase that absorption is to get, like, for instance, vitamin C. So if you're eating fruits and vegetables or other sources of vitamin C along with your meals, that can definitely improve iron absorption. But things like coffee and tea are kind of the opposite. They actually decrease that iron absorption. So if you have a marginal iron intake and a marginal quality diet, eating vitamin C with your meals is one way to do it, in addition to taking iron supplements if you are in fact diagnosed with an iron deficiency. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up I want to do a story that new isn't always better. This from Medical Express. Fewer than half of new drugs add substantial therapeutic value over existing treatments, says study. New drugs are often used not only for one disease, that is their first approved indication, but also for other diseases, that is supplemental indications. But a study published in the British Medical Journal finds that less than half of approved first indications of new drugs in the U.S. and Europe between 2011 and 2020 actually added substantial therapeutic value over existing treatments, and only around a third of supplemental approvals add substantial therapeutic value compared with first approvals. The researchers argue that when first or supplemental indications do not confer added benefit over existing treatments, this information should be clearly communicated to patients and reflected in the price of drugs. The fact that new does not necessarily mean better needs to be clearly communicated to both patients and clinicians, said Beate Weisler at the German Institute of Quality and Efficiency in Healthcare in a linked editorial. The system's current performance does not meet the expectations of patients and the public, clinicians, or policymakers, she writes. Having experienced the potential of a coordinated drug development effort during the COVID-19 pandemic, we should seek to align current legislation on drug development more closely with defined public health goals. Yeah, well, that's pretty much the opposite of a purely profit-driven motive, where you might notice that a lot of the new drugs coming out are like super expensive, tens of thousands of dollars a year. Actually, I think I reported not too long ago that the average price of a new drug was like $104,000 a year. Just stunningly expensive. And of course, there are costs and benefits. And if you have great benefits, you maybe can justify high costs. But most of those drugs do not meet cost-benefit ratios. And to that point exactly, next up from the New York Times, on the latest FDA-approved drug, new federal decisions make Alzheimer's drug Leqembi widely accessible. The Food and Drug Administration last Thursday gave full approval to its Alzheimer's drug Leqembi, and Medicare said it would cover much of its high costs, laying the foundation for widespread use of a medication that can modestly slow cognitive decline in the early stages of the disease, but also carries significant safety risks. The FDA's decision marks the first time in two decades that a drug for Alzheimer's has received full approval, meaning that the agency concluded there is solid evidence of potential benefit. But the agency also added a so-called black box warning, the most urgent level, on the drug's label, stating that in rare cases the drug can cause, quote, serious and life-threatening events, and that there have been cases of brain bleeding, some of which have been fatal. Leqembi cannot, you have to listen to this sentence really carefully. Leqembi cannot repair cognitive damage, reverse the course of disease, or stop it from getting worse. But data from a large clinical trial suggests that the drug, administered every 2 weeks as an intravenous infusion, may slow decline by about 5 months over about 18 months for people with mild symptoms. Still, some Alzheimer's experts have said it's unclear from the medical evidence whether Leqembi's ability to delay erosion of memory and cognition would be even enough to be noticeable or meaningful for patients and their families. The benefits of slowing are subtle. You're not going to experience the perception of changes in your cognition or function in the same amount of time. Not a ringing endorsement. Though Medicare will cover 80% of Leqembi's $26,500 cost per year, patients could still shoulder thousands of dollars in co-payments. Leqembi will be available for people with mild dementia or a pre-Alzheimer's condition called mild cognitive impairment. The FDA label instructs doctors to treat patients without testing to confirm that they have accumulation of the protein amyloid, a hallmark of Alzheimer that Leqembi attacks. About 1.5 million people in the United States are estimated to be in the beginning phases of Alzheimer's. Many more, that is about 5 million, have progressed too far to be eligible for Leqembi. The drug maker recommends patients stop using Leqembi once they develop moderate Alzheimer's disease. The risk to people with two copies of the APOE4 mutation, which is about 15% of people with Alzheimer's, is so high that the FDA's black box warning recommends that all patients be genetically tested to assess their safety risk and spells out those that with two APOE4 copies are more vulnerable to developing symptomatic, serious, and severe brain bleeding or swelling. Still, some patients will be unable to afford the 20% Medicare does not cover, possibly around $6,600 a year, including costs of medical visits and required regular brain scans, some of which will receive Medicare reimbursement. The treatment could run to about $90,000 a year, some experts estimate. You've got small benefits and a certain risk for severe adverse events, and that has to be balanced, said Dr. Lon Schneider, director of the California Alzheimer's Disease Center at the University of Southern California, who said he will prescribe Leqembi to carefully evaluated patients. If its efficacy were greater, we would not be talking about adverse events as much because we could see a clear benefit. I think many people will see this and say it's not worth the effort. It's not worth twice a month infusions. Dr. Jerry Avorn, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, who studies medication regulation and use, said doctors will feel pressure to prescribe Leqembi from patients, families, and advocacy organizations. Medical institutions will also have, a quote, an enormous financial incentive because of the Medicare reimbursement, he said, adding any economically self-respecting memory center is going to see this as an economic windfall. Well, I hope your first criteria for picking a memory center is not that it is economically self-respecting. Not a bad criteria, but probably not in the top three of a list. And to close out my coverage from Leqembi, from a few other articles, I got a couple quotes. Here we go. Currently, a definitive Alzheimer's diagnosis relies either on an invasive or costly PET amyloid scan or a spinal tap to confirm the presence of amyloid in the brain. These technologies present significant barriers for many patients, and without these tools, patients may receive a misdiagnosis, raising concern about our ability to identify the subset of patients who will most benefit from anti-amyloid drugs. Jason Karlowicz, a co-director of the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Memory Center, said he thinks the U.S. health system is unprepared for these new drugs. Fighting over access, he said, misses the point. There's been this rhetoric around the whole need for wide access to the drug that kind of simply misses the fact that the issue is rational access to a drug, Karlowicz said. It's got benefits, it's got risks, it's complicated, and it's landing in a healthcare system that's not ready for it. The most likely consequence of this medication is to take resources and attention away from addressing basic supports for older adults with cognitive impairment, said Maria Glymore, chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. The money spent on expensive drugs like Leqembi would be better invested in fighting diseases like high blood pressure and diabetes, which hasten dementia, and on community-based services for older adults. To me, that's the overall arc of what we can learn from this experiment with such a new drug, is really the opportunity cost. When we're spending intense resources on one thing, we should always be asking, are there better alternatives where we could get a bigger bang for the buck? And I think in this case, even just dealing with things like high blood pressure and diabetes, which hasten dementia, would be much better buys than trying to pump expensive, marginal, and possibly very dangerous drugs to the American populace.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Next up, I'd like to do a case study of sorts on our fragmented healthcare system and how having a more coherent, evidence-based system would work much better. This specific example from Stat News: emergency lights and sirens on ambulances may do more harm than good. Theoretically, lights and sirens save lives by parting seas of traffic to rush patients to hospitals as fast as possible. But research into them shows that only about 5% of EMS patients benefit clinically from quicker transports. Meanwhile, lights and sirens have been found to only save seconds or minutes at most, and almost triple the chance of crashing with a patient on board. And yet, more than three-quarters of 911 transports in the 911 transports to the U.S. medical facility run hot. That is, with lights and sirens rolling. In the field's early days, emergency medical responders mirrored the fire service, which always used lights and sirens. Flames, after all, can engulf a home in just 5 minutes. When every second is precious, so is the speedy arrival of emergency responders. But the earliest EMS providers were drivers, often police officers, morticians, or local volunteers, with little, if any, medical training. "You call, we haul, that's all," was the common industry expression. Valorizing speed in a profession that provided transportation, and not medical care, made sense. Today, however, emergency medics undergo hundreds or thousands of hours of training. "Getting you to the hospital fast is not the value of EMS anymore," said Douglas Kupas, medical director of the National Association of EMTs and president-elect of the National Association of EMS Physicians. Despite their life-saving symbolism, lights and sirens can actively cause harm. A national 2019 study of about 20 million ambulance dispatches found crash rates more than doubled when lights and sirens were blazing during a run to the hospital. Ambulance crashes have immediate and rippling repercussions. The original patient in need of help will have to wait even longer. The EMS agency might have to deploy a rig to tend to its own crash. Already understaffed ambulance services might be out of medic for weeks or months if they are injured. Insurance premiums on the vehicles might go up, and costly equipment inside the truck will likely need replacing. More difficult to track are wake effect crashes, which don't directly involve ambulances. Instead, they're the after effect of a passing ambulance, which causes other drivers on the road to behave unpredictably and erratically, slamming on brakes or suddenly veering to the side. By one measure, every emergency vehicle crash leads to approximately 4 wake effect collisions in its path. And crashes are not the only risk of running hot. Avery, a paramedic in Pennsylvania who asked to be identified by first name only for privacy, said it's challenging to stabilize a patient or communicate with a colleague when they're weaving through traffic, siren screaming. "It can make it harder for me to assess and treat my patients en route if I can't stand up or move around, hear lung sounds over the sirens, or get an accurate blood pressure," he said. "I'd rather have a smooth trip than a quick one where we can make more victims. For patients in critical condition, a harrowing trip to the hospital can cause damaging physiological stress, raising blood pressure and heart rates when oxygen is in precious reserve. For the general public, constant sirens are a nuisance, carry potential health risks, and can be scary and hazardous for people with vision, hearing, or sensory processing disabilities. And once on the scene, paramedics and EMTs have to snap out of the high-octane mindset to provide calm, thoughtful medical care. That adrenaline dump and recovery takes a toll on people, as does regularly flirting with a little danger of a career-ending and life-changing crashes. It's stressful for us and for other drivers on the road, said Matt, a Texas paramedic. It just adds another layer of stress to the job. So why are lights and sirens still such a fixture in EMS? For one, the field is a patchwork of agencies with their own unique structures and regulations. Some are operated by cities or counties, others by hospital systems. Some are nonprofit, others are for-profit private services. Their ranks might be full-time, highly trained professionals, or all volunteer. If you've seen one ambulance service, you've seen one ambulance service. That's a challenge in and of itself. Medicare, EMS's biggest insurer, pays for ambulance transports at two rates, emergency and non-emergency. While Medicare doesn't regulate their use, many EMS billing services use lights and sirens as shorthand for which code to use. Performance agreements with municipalities also often require ambulances to arrive on scene within a particular time window, often 8 minutes or less. For decades, the timestamp was the only indicator of quality in developing these contracts. Many of those timeframes rely on the findings of a 1979 Seattle study that concluded that cardiac arrest patients needed CPR within 4 minutes and definitive care within 10 minutes. But the paper was conducted at a time before the advent of automated and more widely accessible defibrillators and before bystanders could be coached through CPR by emergency dispatchers. Those requirements are archaic. Still, in some cases, regulators define emergency medical services or fine emergency medical services for missing a slim time window. EMS agencies also have dangled lights and sirens to attract adventurous would-be medics. It was a popular recruiting tool. At the same time, the public has been trained over decades to equate lights and sirens with the most glaring and sometimes only perceptible evidence that help is on the way. It's been kind of a community relations tool. You know, we'll be there as fast as possible. Well, it sounds this patchwork system needs a little bit of updating and integration. Okay, well, last up, the feature bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 18 bonus articles this week. First up, U.S. livestock, pet industries, and various animal markets pose disease threats to people. This is a smaller story that covers this larger report, which is bonus article number two. Bonus article two is the report, Animal Markets and Zoonotic Disease in the United States. And this is a long report, but it's a fascinating read for anybody who's curious about the relationship of human beings to animals in the United States, talking about, you know, dog fighting and pets and stalking wildlife and all kinds of stuff. And obviously, livestock, which is about 10 billion livestock that are born each year and die in the U.S. Most of those are chickens. Bonus article three. In Arizona water ruling, the Hopi tribe sees limits on its future. So this is a follow-up of like last week when I talked about the Supreme Court ruling that basically limited water rights. Of course, the irony is that indigenous people see water as life. And unfortunately, the U.S. government doesn't see life and indigenous communities going together. And following up to that story, bonus article four, how private interests benefit from tribal water settlements. Just show me the money and you find out what it's all about. Bonus article five, new Biden initiative targets controversial hospital facility fees that often surprise patients. So this is another one of those things that gets slapped on there that can jack up the profits and trying to clamp down on that. Also part of this initiative, Biden takes aim at junk insurance, vowing to save money for consumers being played as suckers. So these are those short-term, often high deductible and relatively inexpensive because they don't cover much. They don't have the same requirements as other ACA plans require. Bonus article seven. Billing the hospital billing department. This is a satire. If you want a little humor amidst that, check that one out. Bonus article eight, the problems with for-profit nursing programs. Money, money, money often doesn't lead to health, health, health. Bonus article nine, the U.S. banned farmers from using a brain-harming pesticide on food. Why has it slowed a global ban? So we take care of those within our own border, but when it gets outside and dealing with commerce, it's another story. Bonus Article 10. How to lose a century of progress. Fret about imperfect public health delivering huge results. So this is a long story, another story about public health. And kind of a follow-up to that would get to sort of the same point. Bonus Article 11. Pro-vaccine views are winning. Don't fear the skeptics. That public health is a long game with many, many big payoffs, or tons of little payoffs that when you add them up are big payoffs. So just keep up with the fight. Play the long game. You can't beat the house, so play a different game. Public health is that game, a winning game. Bonus Article 12. What could cause a malaria comeback in the U.S. and what could stop it? So we've had the first set of malaria cases in Texas and Florida in 20 years. And this is talking about climate change, different mosquitoes, the fact that we have a halfway decent mosquito control program in the U.S., although there's many local ones and there's some holes in that. So if you want to get the rundown on that, that's a great article. Bonus Article 13, more states legalize sales of unpasteurized milk despite public health warnings. Pasteurization of milk is not harmful and prevents a lot of nasty diseases that you can get from unpasteurized milk. Bonus Article 14, Ohio governor asked Biden to declare disaster over train derailment. So first of all, it hasn't been declared a federal, has not been declared a federal disaster, but the governor's asking, just in case the voluntary efforts that are being made by the rail company let up, and of course, if that's the case, it's going to require a lot of Ohio resources, more than what Ohio could probably provide. Bonus Article 15, Texas pipe operators released or flared tons of gas to avert explosions during a heat wave. Another climate change story and a problem with poor infrastructure that can't deal with expanding gas in the system. Just have to release it or burn it. Bonus Article 16, to save the planet, should we really be moving slower, balancing growth of green technologies while leveraging the degrowth movement? So this is a good long read article from Bill McKibben, great author and activist. And this will really get to the fact that we need to actually grow quickly green technologies, but we also need to slow down growth and do smart growth or degrowth. Bonus Article 17, what to do when you can't fall asleep may surprise you. That would be get up, relax, and do something boring. A good thing about sleep hygiene, sleep being one of the pillars of health. And lastly, 18, how focusing on care can change our relationship to food while building a better world. So this is another big think piece kind of article that gets at the fact that we really build up from having a caring society, a care economy, which can change our relationship to food as well as many other things, building a better world. You can view these and all the other articles at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-